Today is Monday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the U.S. reaches a sobering coronavirus milestone, New Zealand reaches 100 days without the virus.
I don't believe there is any other country that has had COVID come into our position and sustained it away from our borders for that period of time. That actually is a message that it is a very difficult thing to manage.
Public fury continues following last week's devastating explosion in Beirut as some Lebanese call for an uprising.
Just about everyone is mad, scared, and angry at the government.
Also ahead, growing concerns over foreign interference in the upcoming U.S. presidential election. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States set a record for coronavirus cases on Saturday, with more than 5 million people now infected. The United States leads the world in COVID-19 cases and more than 160,000 deaths. That's nearly a quarter of the world's total. Despite a seemingly out-of-control outbreak in the country, talks on Capitol Hill for a new coronavirus economic relief bill remain at an impasse, and that led President Donald Trump to bypass Congress and sign executive orders. Aisha Sarai has more.
In the absence of new legislation from Capitol Hill, President Trump this weekend signed executive orders promising some economic relief to the unemployed, but shifting the financial responsibility to individual states.
I'm taking action to provide an additional or an extra $400 per week in expanded benefits. $400, okay? So that's generous, but we want to take care of our people. Again, it wasn't their fault. It was China's fault. States will be asked to cover 25% of the cost using existing funding.
Democrats, who have pushed to maintain a $600 weekly benefit to at least 18 million unemployed Americans, say the order does not do enough.
Unfortunately, the president's executive orders, described in one word, could be paltry. In three words, unworkable, weak, and far too narrow. The event at the country club is just what Trump does, a big show, but it doesn't do anything.
The order also includes a deferment of payroll taxes, but does not protect Americans at risk of eviction.
There's no money to help us with elections, no money to help us with the post office, very little money to feed children, no money to feed children, and no real help for eviction of people. So they leave out a lot.
But the Trump administration maintains that its quick action was necessary because of gridlock on Capitol Hill.
The Democrats rejected various compromises at least twice, to my knowledge. The president felt he had to take action, and it will be timely action, and it will be temporary action, to be sure.
Some critics have questioned the legality of Trump's executive orders and expect to see lawsuits challenging their authority. Under U.S. law, Congress must approve spending legislation. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told Fox News Sunday Trump's actions were cleared by his legal advisors. Aisha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
Public health experts agree, wear a mask, wash your hands, and observe social distancing. These are the guidelines to help control the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. But as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, while global cases approach 20 million, an anti-mask movement threatens containment.
Friday in Sturgis, South Dakota, the 80th annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally rolled into town despite public health concerns of COVID-19. Rallygoers didn't seem concerned about the advice of public health experts who say social distancing and mask wearing are key to controlling the spread of the virus that's now infected more than 5 million Americans.
No, we didn't take any precautions as we normally don't. We think the majority of this situation is manufactured. There's ulterior motives behind it.
Rallygoers like Jim Bush call risks of contagion overblown, despite mountains of public health evidence to the contrary.
And good afternoon. My administration has...
President Donald Trump has worn a mask in public on rare occasions. Leading U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says safety regarding the coronavirus is simple.
That avoid crowds of any type, no matter where you are, because that leads to the acquisition and transmission. And I don't judge one crowd versus another crowd. When you're in a crowd, particularly if you're not wearing a mask, that induces the spread.
Yet a growing movement around the world challenges science and expert advice like those at this anti-mask rally in Stuttgart, Germany.
I'm here because I believe in Jesus Christ. This whole coronavirus is an anti-Christ issue. It is mostly against our Savior, Jesus Christ. Many don't know that. They don't know that it is really against God.
Others call for personal responsibility in protecting public health.
I think it's so selfish. Actually, these rules are necessary at this period of time. Otherwise, this virus can spread so easily. Maybe for younger people, it's not that much awful or dangerous. But on purposely, we can affect other people.
Locals estimate the crowd in Stuttgart at around 2,000, while back in South Dakota, local officials expect roughly 100,000 visitors to the 10-day Sturgis motorcycle rally, which usually draws about 500,000 attendees. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
New Zealand Sunday marked 100 days since it stamped out the spread of the coronavirus, a rare bright spot in the world that continues to be ravaged by the disease. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, whose leadership has been widely praised for imposing a strict lockdown in late March when only about 100 people had tested positive for the disease, is pleased but cautious.
100 days is a significant period of time, but it actually doesn't lessen any of the risk. That's daily, as long as we are continuing to, of course, exist in a world where this pandemic is growing, then risk continues.
But for the past 3 months, the only new cases in New Zealand have been a handful of returning travelers who have been quarantined at the border. Life has pretty much returned to normal for many in the South Pacific nation of 5 million, but some there do worry the country may be getting complacent and not preparing well enough for any future outbreaks. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of Beirut's city center over the weekend, calling for top political figures to step down as anger hit a boiling point across Lebanon following last week's massive explosion at Beirut port that rocked the city, killed at least 150 people, wounded close to 4,000, and left a quarter of a million people homeless. As international aid continues to pour into the country, a number of political leaders are calling for an international investigation. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Lebanese security forces fired tear gas at thousands of protesters gathered in Beirut city center demanding that political leaders step down in the aftermath of Tuesday's bloody explosion that devastated large swaths of the capital. Protesters also stormed the foreign ministry. The Lebanese Red Cross reports more than a dozen protesters have been taken to hospitals and scores are being treated at the scene. Visiting Arab League head Ahmed Abu Ghait told journalists the 22-member body would support Lebanon through all available means after meeting with President Michel Aoun. Abu Ghait and other world leaders, including U.S. President Donald Trump, say they will take part Sunday in a donors conference for Lebanon in Paris. Sami Jamil, son of former Lebanese President Amin Jamil and head of the Kata'ib party, received a wave of applause Saturday as he told mourners at the funeral of his party's Secretary General Nazar Najarian that he was withdrawing his three MPs from parliament. Druze leader Wali Jumblatt, who heads the Progressive Socialist Party, told Arab media he was calling for an international investigation into the explosion at Beirut port, as well as fresh parliamentary elections. He adds that protesters have a right to ask political leaders to step down. Jumblatt says he understands the wrath of the people and that it is up to Christian protesters and the major Christian parties to call for an end to the mandate of the current president. Christian political leader Dr. Samir Jaja also called for early parliamentary elections. He stopped short, however, of withdrawing his party's MPs from parliament. Hisham Harb, a student at the Lebanese University, told VOA that just about everyone is mad, scared, and angry. Angry at the government, at the politicians, and at what he called the gangsters who run the country. Everyone, he says, has friends and family members who were killed or injured in the explosion, and everyone is mad as hell. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The top U.S. counterintelligence official on Friday warned that Russia, China, and Iran will all try to interfere in the 2020 presidential election, with Russia already trying to undercut Democratic candidate Joe Biden. President Trump, on Saturday at a news conference at his Bedminster Golf Club, was asked if he believes the intelligence reports.
It could be. I mean, I could be very much. I think that the last person Russia wants to see in office is Donald Trump, because nobody's been tougher on Russia than I have ever. Well, I don't care what anybody says.
The information and reaction from the president sparked strong words from Democrats. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer telling ABC's This Week that Russia is interfering in the U.S. presidential election and there is a bipartisan bill in Congress to stop it, using sanctions.
Why does Donald Trump not want to stop Russia from interfering in this election? You have to ask that question. It's the wellspring of our democracy.
In an unusual public statement, William Evanina, director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, said the three countries were using online disinformation and other means to try to influence voters, stir up disorder, and undermine American voters' confidence in the democratic process. Meanwhile, Americans are awaiting word from Joe Biden on an announcement, possibly this week, on who he has chosen to be his vice presidential running mate. One big constituency the Biden campaign hopes to sway is young voters, a group with historically low voter participation. But more and more Americans coming of age to vote are becoming politically aware and active about issues that will impact their future, including racial injustice and climate change. Joining us to talk more about it is Nina Agrawal Hardin, an activist with youth-based organization Sunrise Movement. Nina, thank you so much for being with us. Do you think that younger voters will turn out, will show up this November? And if so, who are they likely to be voting for?
We know that young people are generally left-leaning, right? And so I think it's going to depend on what Democrats do between now and November to engage with young people and to appeal to young people. I think that if we have a presidential nominee and a whole bunch of down ballot candidates that are not speaking to the issues that young people care about and making an effort to reach out to that base, then it is entirely possible that young people won't show up in November because, you know, young people feel like nobody's listening to them and they feel disenfranchised. But I think that if Vice President Biden and a lot of those down ballot candidates do make an effort to appeal to young voters by talking about the issues that we care about, you know, by talking about climate justice and racial justice and a lot of those issues that are really important to a younger generation, then I think we could very well see historic youth turnout in November, because I think young people do know that the stakes are high and young people do understand that this is not like any other election.
What would you say some of the most important issues are for younger people, the younger generations of voters?
I think there's actually a baseline understanding among young voters that the issues that we care about are all interconnected, right? Like, we care about a raise of the minimum wage. We care about fixing the systemic racial injustice that plagues our country. We certainly care about solving the climate crisis. Those are just to name a few, but we understand that those issues are interconnected and that they are symptomatic of a society and of a government that, you know, fundamentally favors the interests of a wealthy few over the interests of, you know, the people that they purport to serve. And so I think that for young voters, it's like, yes, there are all these little pieces of the issue, but what we really want is a bold and systemic transformation in this country and across the world.
It would seem that this generation has a keen understanding that I think a lot of previous generations just sort of ignored. Is that safe to say?
I think so. And I think that the reason behind that is because our generation has already lived through multiple recessions, through the complete mishandling of a global pandemic, through numerous climate disasters like Hurricane Katrina. Like, I think we've never known an America that seems fair and safe and stable. And so it's when that's kind of been the backdrop of your childhood, you do kind of have to develop an understanding that something's not right.
The Sunrise Movement, does it have one mission, or is it more focused on transformation with a variety of issues regarding the people of the future of this planet?
Sunrise is fundamentally about climate justice, but I think what's actually unique and groundbreaking about Sunrise is we don't believe that you can solve climate change without addressing systemic race racism, without addressing colonial violence against indigenous peoples, without addressing the way that our society benefits wealthy people and leaves poor people out to dry. So I think that Sunrise is centered around this idea of a Green New Deal, this idea of a just transition. And that's because we don't think climate change can be solved without addressing all of the many intersectionalities of the issue. So on the one hand, yes, it's focused on this issue of climate change. And on the other hand, no, because we don't believe that climate change is a single issue. We believe it's huge, a massive, huge intersectional issue.
You said their vote will depend on whether or not candidates really show their commitment to real change, real transformation within all of these areas, which are all connected. Is there a point of compromise where they would feel like something is better than nothing, or is that just more a status quo, giving a little bit to just sort of cosmetically fix a problem and not really actually getting to the root of all of it?
If we don't see like calls for systemic change from the Democrats, people still turn out on the premise that something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. I can say what Sunrise believes. I can say what I believe, which is that from a movement perspective, even though I think a lot of young people see the same systems kind of upheld by the Republicans and the Democrats at this point, I think that from a movement perspective, it is going to be so much better to have Vice President Biden in office from the point of who can we hold accountable and who can we move on the issues that we care about? Who is going to be even just slightly more accountable to us? And then there's also, you know, the idea of harm reduction, which is it's hard to get to motivate yourself to vote on harm reduction. But the fact remains that there are lives that will be saved if we vote Donald Trump out of office. And so I think because of that idea of harm reduction and because of the idea of like who can we hold accountable through continuing to protest and escalating our protest and who is going to be at least movable, I hope and I think that some young people will turn out no matter what. But I can't say how many, because it is true that for so long, we've just felt like our votes are taken for granted and the things that are important to us are not addressed. So I think if Vice President Biden wants to make sure that he has the strongest turnout from young people that he possibly can, then he should speak to our issues. And if not, the cards will fall where they may. But personally, I hope and think that people will turn out to make the next 4 years of movement work slightly easier.
Has he spoken to your issues? Have you guys reached out to the Biden campaign?
Yeah, actually, Varshini Prakash, our executive director, is on the Biden-Sanders task force for climate. And so that's been really cool. And I know that there's collaboration between Sunrise and the Biden campaign, because ultimately, we want to see Trump out of office. And we know that Joe Biden needs young voters to make that happen. So we're doing our best to help him earn our votes.
Youth activist Naina Agrawal-Hardin with the Sunrise Movement. A group of French nationals, along with their guide and a driver, were ambushed and killed Sunday in a wildlife park in Niger Sunday. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but France and other countries have warned people against traveling to parts of Niger, where militants, including Boko Haram and an affiliate of Islamic State, operate. Paris-based journalist Catherine Field joins us for details. Catherine, tell us what is known so far.
We know that a group of six aid workers were being driven around a popular tourist area to the southeast of the capital, Niamey. They were there looking around the giraffe reserve when a group of armed men came out of nowhere. They were on motorbikes and they were clearly ambushed, and all of the people on board the vehicle died. That is the six aid workers and the two guides, one of whom was the president of the local Giraffe Guides Association. So two locals were also killed.
The French nationals, what do we know about why they were in the country?
It's an NGO that is based here in Paris. They operate in some 37 countries around the world. It's an NGO that particularly works with displaced people. They've been working in Niger for some time. They've been particularly helping out with people who have been displaced through the effects of climate change, as well as people who have been affected by the ongoing insurgency and violence from groups linked to various Islamic groups in the area.
What, if anything, has French President Emmanuel Macron said about this? Has he responded at all? And what does this mean for the French presence in Niger?
President Macron has already spoken on the phone to his counterpart in Niger. The French military, who have a base in the capital, Niamey, have said that they will send some of their specialists to the region to help gain any information that they can on who was responsible for this attack. The more of the concern here is this happened in a region that generally hasn't had that many attacks. It's been a region which has been popular with tourists. People have gone out. And certainly the sign this is that the militant groups that are operating in this area are tending to move out, are spreading out a lot more than we've seen in the past. So if you like, it's a new challenge to the French forces there, the Balkan forces, if you like, a way of saying to the French, we are here, you are not going to be able to impose your military ways on us, and we are just as active. I mean, the only other attacks that have been in this area was really way back in 2017 when 4 US and 5 Nigerian soldiers were killed in an attack there. So this really does show that despite the fact that the government there has banned the use of motorbikes, the preferred method of transport for these militants, that these militants were riding motorbikes, were able to move around quite quickly. So it's a real, if you like, it's a real sign of defiance to the French forces, to the Balkan forces, who are there operating in that area.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Here are some of these stories we are following at VOA. An earthquake has shaken much of the U.S. state of North Carolina, rattling homes, buildings, and residents. The National Weather Service in Greenville said the 5.1 magnitude tremor, which struck Sunday, was the largest earthquake to hit the state since 1916. The quake was felt in nearby states, including Virginia, South Carolina, and Tennessee. Belarus voted in an election Sunday, pitting President Alexander Lukashenko against a former teacher who emerged from obscurity to lead the biggest challenge in years against the man who has ruled the country for a quarter of a century. 65-year-old Lukashenko is almost certain to win a sixth consecutive term, but could face a new wave of protests amid anger over his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, the economy, and his human rights record. And Afghanistan agreed on Sunday to release 400 hardcore Taliban prisoners, paving the way for the beginning of peace talks aimed at ending more than 19 years of war. Under election year pressure from U.S. President Donald Trump for a deal allowing him to bring home American troops, the war-torn country's Grand Assembly on Sunday approved the release, controversial condition raised by the Taliban militants to join peace talks. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues.
From high-definition TV broadcasts to shiny new on-screen graphics to laid-back video blogs, North Korean state media have been getting a makeover, but the cosmetic changes won't be able to alter North Korea's perception as one of the world's most censored and isolated countries, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
When you think of North Korean state TV, this is what may come to mind. A traditionally dressed news anchor, melodramatically singing the praises of the dear leader. But these days, North Korean state media also sounds like this.
Good day to you, my friend. I was wondering how you're doing these days.
Meet Eun Ah, who calls herself an ordinary North Korean girl. For about the last 6 months, she's appeared in these laid-back, blog-style videos, speaking in English as she tours Pyongyang.
Good afternoon. This is Una from Pyongyang. Today, I come up with three new updates about DPRK.
The videos have received over 1.6 million views on YouTube. They're also posted to a Twitter account called Cold Noodle Fan, which has links to North Korea's government, says Colin Swerko of the Seoul-based NK News.
It's a ruse. It's not just a person in Pyongyang reporting about all the things they love about the country.
Zwerko and NK News have followed the Cold Noodle Fan account for years, and he says its persona has changed dramatically.
Late 2017 or early 2018, they wrote that they were a poor person living in Japan, and then later they became a Russian named Yulia.
The Un-A videos are designed for a foreign audience, apparently with the goal of improving North Korea's image internationally. But the country's domestic broadcasts have also been upgraded. In recent years, North Korean state TV has gone high definition. Its announcers are younger, studios more modern, and its news stories make use of techniques seen in foreign broadcasts, including B-roll and establishing shots. It's even experimented with complex 3D infographics. The changes appear to be an acknowledgement that North Korean media faces competition from much more advanced content produced in South Korea and elsewhere. A lot of that content is smuggled across the border. Martin Williams, who follows North Korean state media.
If you watch a South Korean TV drama, the production quality is a lot higher than a lot of North Korean TV fare. So, the audience is beginning to expect some of that.
But while the broadcasts are visually more appealing, Williams says it's far from clear whether they'll be more effective, in part because the changes are only cosmetic.
What hasn't changed is the content. It is still the same old boring stuff. It is reports on things that Kim Jong-un has done. When Kim Jong-un hasn't done anything, they go back to places that he visited 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years ago.
Even Una's blog-style videos can be heavy-handed.
Hi, hello, good morning.
In this video, Una is going for a jog. It's a chance to show off parts of the city, which is much wealthier than other parts of the country. But as the camera pans, large segments of the neighborhood are blurred out. A seemingly random instance of state censorship that Una never even explains. It's a reminder that even though North Korea may be trying to improve its image, meaningful changes appear nowhere on the horizon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
I do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling? Feeling good.
MTV has abandoned the idea of holding its Video Music Awards show at an indoor venue in New York because of the complications of the coronavirus epidemic. The VMA show on August 30th, which traditionally features live performances from music's biggest stars, will go ahead instead with some artists performing at outdoor locations. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bundanyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Balance it. Like to stay on top of new music trends? Breakout artists? New releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 15... 15-